This morning, we have our brother Jim Stiles from Livonia, Michigan, here to give us the words on working Ezra, working together in the Ecclesias. And today's topic is going to be Don't Give Up When Things Go Wrong. Our brother Jim.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Maybe if we finish a little bit early, we can get cruising earlier. That sounds like the highlight of the day. Maybe we should try cruising through a few chapters of Ezra so we can get caught up, too. It's one of the problems with these Bible school classes. We try to hit some of the highlights as you're going through these chapters. But really, our study of Ezra this week, brothers and sisters, is just going to be a cursory overview and a look at some of the things that are happening so that for any of you that want to study Ezra in a little more detail, you can do that at your leisure. My goal is to just try to familiarize ourselves with the story, what's happening, and what I think are some of the major lessons that we're supposed to be getting from this as to why God put this book in our Bibles and what he is trying to accomplish. So we looked yesterday at how the seventh month had come in Ezra chapter 3, and the people had gathered together at the beginning of the chapter. They'd gathered as one man. Now, you'll notice that theme that comes up in Ezra and Nehemiah, how they gathered together as one man. And they came, and you can see the unity that was coming together in the ecclesial world. But see, just like as a result of the adversity of 9/11, and people would come together, and you could see, and as somebody mentioned to me, that it was also under the great leadership sometimes, that it takes a leader who will stand up and unite these people, as Joshua and Zerubbabel are doing here. You have the political leader in Zerubbabel and the priesthood leader in Joshua, and the two of them are completely united on the goal. And ecclesial life is working at its peak at this point as everybody's coming together. The building of the altar, the keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles in Ezra chapter 3 at verse 4. And you can see again in verse 5 of this chapter, of Ezra chapter 3, that the people brought things. Everyone it mentions, who willingly offered a free will offering to the Lord. The spirit was such that they were generating that people wanted to be involved in ecclesial life. And they were freely, willingly offering, which is the kind of offering that God is after. And from in verse 6 of chapter 3, that from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer the burnt offerings, but the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not yet been laid. See, this had not yet happened. They hadn't actually seen any of the temple yet. And at this point in time, before any of the temple had been built, everybody came together, united as one man. They were all on the same game plan, and everybody was marching ahead, and the ecclesia was united. But once the project started, you see, that's when things get tricky in ecclesial life. The project starts. You look down at verse 8 of this of chapter 3. In the second month of the second year of their coming to Jerusalem. So we're only in the second year. Only a year has gone by. And the ecclesia has been united for a year, and here we go. Zerubbabel and Joshua, they get together, and the rest of the Levites. And in verse 8, at the end of that verse, they began work and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. And so they begin, and here we go. They start working on the building. Verse 10, that when the builders laid the foundation of the temple, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord, according to the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And you can tell that they're following David's rules because they started these at 20 years old and upward, whereas the original work, back in verse 8 of this chapter, when it mentions the 20 years old and up, originally, back in the law, it had been 25 years old and up, but David had changed that. So they must have had access to David's writings and his ordinances, as it mentions here, and they're following David's rules because it appears as though once the tabernacle had come to a fixed position and the temple was being built, David foresaw that it was okay for these Levites to start a little bit earlier, and he allowed them to start at 20 years old and upward as opposed to 25. And so what we run into is that they're going to begin building the temple. And this temple takes place, you can see in the handout that I gave you today, that big white sheet, if you got that, that gives you the period of the Persian kings. And you can get a bit of an idea as to how the temple building is going to go on. It's a period of history, so there's a little bit of history in today's class, but not a whole lot. And we don't have to know a whole lot of Persian kings and their names to figure this all out. But the temple building takes place over a 20-year period. It took 20 years to get this building going and to get it finally completed. And it went over the period of Cyrus for about 6 years. And then Cyrus's son named Cambyses, he came in for about 8 years of the building of the temple. Then there was a fake king that came in, this fellow we call Pseudo-Smertus, or some people refer to him as Gomedes. He was only in for about 7 months, and he really was not supposed to be king. According to what everybody can piece together in the historical records, is that the angels orchestrated an event at this point where a fake king came along. It was an imposter, and he came to the reign of the throne for only a seven-month period, and then he was overthrown, and Darius Hystaspes then takes over, and the temple's finished then when they start working it again in the second year of Darius, and they finished it then in the sixth year. So you've got about a 20-year period. And which is interesting because that 20-year period allows for this little gap that took place from the time period when the first exiles were taken, back in the days when Daniel went, for example, until finally at the end of Zedekiah's life, you're looking at about a 20-year period in there at the end of the kings of Israel. And that 20-year period, that little 20-year window from the period of the first exile till finally when Zedekiah went, this is what caused some of the trouble in the community, where people were wondering, is the time really right? Should we really be building this temple right now? And that's the kind of thing that you're going to see coming up in this section right now today. So as they're building along and they're doing their work, you can see that they were following the directions that David had left for them, and they're trying to follow the directions that David had as good as possible. And you can see some of the things that are actually there. In verse 10 and 11, when they reenact 2 Chronicles 5, when Solomon brought the ark into the temple, it's also, when you look at verse 11, it's actually quoted from 1 Chronicles 16 and also from 2 Chronicles 5, both times where major events were happening, which illustrates that they must have had these records. Somebody must have had copies of these records and realized that this is what David did, this is what Solomon did, so they were attempting to follow the directions that were in the law, trying to do their best at this time with the resources that they had as starting to work on this temple. But look at what happens when the work begins. And this is so typical of ecclesial projects. Once you get going on the work, then we start to find out, well, is everybody still on board? So in verse 11, they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever towards Israel. Then all the people, they shouted with a great shout, and when they praised the Lord because of the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. So here's the work beginning. And they were laying all these foundation stones upon which the entire rest of the building would actually rise up at this point. And it was really important to get the foundation laid correctly. But look what happens in verse 12. And this is so typical of ecclesial life. But, there's that word, but many of the priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses, who were old men, who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes, yet many shouted aloud for joy. And now we have division in the ranks. There's two different camps of people. There were the older folks who could remember what the first temple looked like. They could still remember what all the glory that had been there in the temple that Solomon had built. And those people could remember what the first one looked like. And now they see this temple going up, and their shouting is one of crying. They're disappointed. They're discouraged over the fact that this is not going to be what we had before. It's not going to be like the old one. And the older people at this point were putting a bit of a squash on the excitement and the joy of the younger people that were doing their job. So in verse 13, the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people, for the people shouted with a loud shout, and the shout was heard afar off. Now, that division that developed, brethren and sisters, is one that in ecclesial life and in family life, we've got to really be careful about. It is so easy for divisions to creep up in ecclesial life amongst the older and the younger, where we're out of touch with one another, where we don't realize and don't value sometimes the work that our younger people are doing. Sometimes as older members of ecclesias, we remember what it used to be like. We remember the way we did it in the old days, and we think that that's the only right way to do it. And unless our young people can come up to that kind of a level, unless they can live that life, unless they can do these projects the way we did back then, that the projects, they're not as good. They're not worthwhile, and we can so easily discourage our young people. Those young people that they don't remember those days. They don't have that in their background. What our young people are doing is they're trying to do the best that they can with the resources that they currently have available today and with the young people that they currently have to work with today, and they're trying to do their best. And it is so easy to discourage those young people. Now, those kids that are up there, you see their enthusiasm in our teen classes, and they're going to be coming along in ecclesial life, and they're going to have ideas about how we can do witnessing activities, what we might be able to do around our halls and landscaping activities, what kind of events we can have, activities that we can schedule, and they're going to have these ideas about what they want to do. And it's great. Let them plan those things and let them do them. And if they don't come out exactly right, that's okay. We learn that way too, but we don't ever want to discourage those young people and their enthusiasm when they're doing the best that they can with the resources that they have. And this is the problem that developed in ecclesial life back here in Ezra, and it's a problem that can happen for ourselves today, brothers and sisters, if we're not careful. The younger people were excited. They thought this was great. The work is starting and we're finally getting going, and they're yelling and they're shouting and they're praising God for what they were getting. And the older people were crying and remembering what it was like in the old days. They remembered what it used to be like. And it's not good for ecclesial unity. And you can see that what happens, this is going to come up. This is not just happening right now. We are on that white sheet, we are at the beginning of the building. And this problem was spanning over that 20 years of which they were building, or at least over like 16 years until they finally got going again in the second year of Darius. And finally, those last 4 years, they seemed to be a little more committed to accomplishing the work and getting it all done. But Haggai and Zechariah come along after 16 years of working on this temple, and they're still trying to deal with this issue. As Haggai says, "Is it not in your sight as nothing?" You see, Haggai realized this was a current problem. After 16 years, some of the people were still looking at the building and they were saying, "It's not good enough. It's worthless. It's not like what we used to have. This is no good. Why are we even bothering to work on this anymore? Because it's just not like what we used to have." And Zechariah has the same problem in Zechariah 4. We will see as we go along and we get into tomorrow when Zechariah tries to stimulate these people to get working. And he says, "Look, who has despised the day of small things?" Sure, it might be a day of small things. Maybe it's not as big as it used to be. Maybe it's not as glamorous and beautiful as it used to be. But this day of small things, you might despise it. But do you know those angels up in heaven? They're singing for joy and they're rejoicing that this work is getting done and they want to see it completed because they've been trying a lot harder than you to get this work done. And you're going to see that come right out of Zechariah chapter 4 tomorrow. In those first four chapters of Zechariah, those angels, they are out there working and working to get this work done, and they can't wait until it's accomplished. And you can imagine them back homes in our ecclesias when we go back there next week. And those angels are working away with our young people. They are trying to build that spiritual house. They're working with each one of those teenage kids, and they're trying to build them into a stone that will fit into that temple. Don't ever squash their work. Don't ever discourage those young people. Build on the positive things. Encourage them about what they're doing right, and encourage them to keep working, and encourage them that what they are doing now is good and it's great, and ask and volunteer to help. What can we do to help you out when they're planning their activities and they're trying to accomplish their CYC goals or working in the Sunday schools? Because we want to encourage them to be involved in every way possible and never, never despise that day of small things. Well, where we're at right now, if you have a look on the white sheet that you've got, what I tried to do on that page is to give you, along the timeline right here, here is Cyrus up here along the timeline, and these are all the Persian kings that we're going to need for our study in Ezra this week. So there aren't a whole lot of them. In fact, actually, I think you can look at the whole list right here going right through Xerxes and Artaxerxes Longimanus, and I'll just mention these a little bit later on, and you'll see that they come up in the discussions. But I don't personally believe they're actually involved in the story of Ezra at all. I really believe that all we're dealing with are these four kings right here. We know that the temple is finished in the sixth year of this Darius Hystaspes right here. So the vast majority of all the things that we're looking at in the entire book of Ezra are actually running through this little period right here. It starts around 530 BC when Cyrus made his decree and the people came back, and it ends when you're looking at the second year of Darius. You're only looking at a very small historical period in the sixth year of Darius when the temple was finally finished. So hopefully that won't involve too much for all of us to keep track of. But when you look at what's going to happen in Ezra chapter 4 as we follow this through today, what you will see is the people started the work. They started building here when the temple was started in 536, and it took 20 years for this temple to get finished. During that period when this project was going on, what ended up happening is the people became more and more discouraged. They started out initially on a high, and they were all working, they were all gathered as one man, they were ready to go, and then they had the internal struggles of the young and the old, and then they got discouraged. And then they had the adversaries come along from outside the ecclesial world, and they discouraged them too. And what happened in the ecclesial building project is that the interest waned and it declined and it declined until finally, in the end, God gave them what they wanted and the work stopped. And you know, that's such a warning in ecclesial life, brothers and sisters. It's such a warning to ourselves that when we complain, when we get discouraged, when we can't keep up that enthusiasm, when all we can say are negative things about ecclesial life, don't be surprised in the end if God gives us what we wanted. If we're that negative and if we're that upset about the projects and we always find something wrong with that goes on in ecclesial projects, then in the end, God may take away those projects. Or if we're always saying things about our spouse that's negative, if we say things that are not upbuilding and we're not encouraging one another, don't be surprised in the end if the only thing our angels can do to teach us a lesson is take our spouse away or our children or whatever it might be. We don't want to put our angels in a predicament where they're sort of forced to deal with those issues and make us face them. We want to straighten it out now so that we can work together. We can appreciate all the value that everybody brings to family life and ecclesial life so that we never have to suffer through those circumstances that we've watched in others. Learn from others and learn from what they've gone through so that we don't have to experience those things ourselves and learn them the hard way. We tell our children that, but as adults, we're no different. We're no different as adults. We've got to learn from the experiences of others so that we don't have to suffer through those things ourselves and try to learn as much as we can from other people when they go through those problems. So, if nothing else this week, brothers and sisters, let's try to go away enthusiastic about what's going on in our families, in our ecclesias, and build each other up. Husbands and wives, build each other up. Look at the positive things and remember and remind each other every day about thanks for what you did, the positive things that our spouse does for us or for our children or for our ecclesia, and quit focusing in on the negatives, because every one of us has a bunch of negatives. We all do. And our angels know us inside out, and we could stand before those angels and when Christ sends out his angels to gather the elect, and those angels could do exactly what we sometimes do. They could just go right through our life and say all those things that we did wrong. And that's not the way we want to be treated. And let's not treat others that way either. Let's look at the positive things that we can do for one another and build on those positive things and try to put together God's spiritual house. Now, in Ezra chapter 4, what ends up happening in Ezra chapter 4 is that it's possible that what the angels did is that they threw at the ecclesia this issue. If we're not united, and if we have this problem of younger and older and not appreciating what we have, it's possible that what the angels did is they brought into ecclesial life the very issues that would force them to try to get back together and working in unity. And so what they did is instead of arguing with each other, they brought a new enemy into the midst, a new adversary. And sometimes that works in ecclesial life. We end up having another problem, and then we have to deal with that problem, and then we learn how to work together, or maybe in family life. But I really believe our goal is to not put the angels in a situation where they have to do these kind of things. So in Ezra chapter 4, look at what happens. The very disappointments of chapter 3 may have led to the circumstances that we're leading up to in chapter 4, where now, as the shout was heard afar off at the end of chapter 3, now the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the Lord God of Israel. Now the people around the community, the adversary, and see how they're presented right here? These are not people that are going to be folks that are like sort of interested and not sort of interested. The Bible makes it very clear that from the beginning, these people were adversaries. They really didn't have the best interest of the Jewish community in mind, of these people that were coming back from the captivity. These people, what they want, they were really presented from the beginning as being adversaries to the community. And what they do is they come to Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses in verse 2, and they say to him, "Oh, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we've sacrificed to him since the days of Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, who brought us here." And this would be like the son of Sennacherib. You're going back over 130 years. This is back when the northern kingdom was taken and they were removed. And the Assyrians back in those days, their strategy used to be to take people out of their lands and scatter them all over their kingdom and then bring other people and scatter them. And what they would do is they would move and they would translocate all these different people because their strategy was, well, if we divide them all up and split them all up, they can never rebel against us because these people would all have different backgrounds and different cultures and they wouldn't be able to unite together and rebel against the kingdom. And that was their way of trying to control the kingdom. A good Bible passage to Bible mark at this point as far as like background to the Samaritans, to these people, these adversaries, would be to go back and have a look at 2 Kings chapter 17. Because in 2 Kings 17, you have the true background to where these Samaritans came from. When you look back in 2 Kings 17, you can see that, remember the story that what had happened is that the northern kingdom was dissolving and disappearing. The Assyrians were carrying them away. So what they would do is that they brought in people from other nations, and they found out, well, that things weren't going well in the land. And so they brought in priests to try to teach them a little bit about Yahweh, because all these different nations had their own gods. But you can see it in verse 29, however, that every nation continued to make gods of its own. So all these other nations that came in to the northern kingdom, they all made their own gods. They put them in shrines in the high places, which the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities where they dwelt. You look down in verse 32, that they feared Yahweh, so Yahweh became one of their gods. So they feared Yahweh, the God of the land, and from every class they appointed for themselves priests of the high places, who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. So yes, they had Yahweh worship going on. They feared Yahweh in verse 33, yet they served their own gods according to the rituals of the nations among whom they were carried away. To this day they continue practicing the former rituals. They do not fear Yahweh, nor do they follow their statutes or their ordinances or the law and the commandment which Yahweh had commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. And so the summary verse down at verse 40 is that, however, they did not obey. They followed their former rituals. And so these nations feared Yahweh, yet served their carved images. And that's the background for these adversaries. These people had been brought in from other nations. They were not really Jews. They knew about Yahweh, the God of Israel. Oh, yes, they knew about him. But they also had all their other gods and their rituals that they brought with them, all their pagan practices. And so here come these people, and they come to Joshua and Zerubbabel, and they say, "Okay, let's go. We want to help out. Let us help in this work of building your temple." So here comes the first test. And you can see how the angels would throw this at the captives. Are they ready? Are they going to go back to the very problem that caused the captivity, or have they learned anything from this? You know, this is the kind of thing that would be fun to do as angels, where you run these tests into people's lives. Did we learn anything from our last experiences? Did we learn anything from the experiences of our parents? Because some of these younger people weren't really part of the captivity. They'd come back, but they really weren't those that had been carried away captive. But the first test is that idol worship had caused the captivity in the first place. It was the primary cause. God could not get these idols out of their hearts. These people had, back at those times, they had infiltrated in with the other nations, they had learned their customs, they had gotten their idols, and now the question was, Are these captives ready to make a stand on idol worship? Are they willing to do that and separation from the world? Are they willing to do that? And so what happens is Joshua and Zerubbabel, you can imagine the AB meetings they would have had as the elders got together and they discussed this and the debates would have been going on. Well, you know, what do you think we ought to do? And some of the people would say, well, that's great. We need help. This will make our work easier. We'll get help from these people. They'll help us build the temple. This is fantastic. Maybe we can teach them the truth too while we're at it and we'll let them be a part of this community and we'll just bring them in like this and maybe this will work. And the others were saying, wait a minute. This is what caused the problem. We've got to make sure these people are committed before they help in our building. These people don't really worship our God like we do. These people have all these other gods that they worship as well, and they don't really fear Yahweh. They just want to help us in this project so they can intermix with us in the land and get their value out of us, and they don't really care about Yahweh, the God that we worship. There's no interest in trying to live like Yahweh. They don't really care about him at all. They've got all these other customs. And the debate would have gone on and on. And finally, the answer comes out in verse 3 that Joshua and Zerubbabel and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses, they were united when they came to present the decision. And they said, you may do nothing with us to build a house for our God, but we alone will build to Yahweh, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus had declared. Now, it's a tremendous example, brethren and sisters, of people that were willing to make a stand. They made a stand at this point because they could not see mixing with the people of this world in the building of the house of God. You see, now, they were not against employing people. Like we found that when you look at some of the things back in the previous chapter, like in chapter 3 at verse 7, it's interesting to note where they drew their line. In chapter 3 and verse 7, they gave money to the masons and the carpenters and food and drink and oil to the people of Sidon and Tyre. These were foreigners, to bring cedar logs from Lebanon to the sea at Joppa according to the permission which they had from Cyrus, king of Persia. So they were willing to subcontract out resources and say, look, we want to buy your things. We'll pay you, and we want to buy your things. We're going to make an economic arrangement, and we'll buy your services. But when it came time to erecting the house, there were going to be no foreign workers on the site. And I think those are the kind of lines in family life and ecclesial life we have to be really careful about. There are some times where, yes, we need the resources of those in this world, and we go to them to try to find some help. And we may even at times employ them to be a part of the building projects. But when it comes time to building our children in CYC and our Sunday schools and our ecclesias, and we get together with our meetings and we are going to worship our God, there are times where we draw the line as to who will be a part of our community and the worship of our God. We don't want to bring in the pagan ideas and the false gods and all the things that come with them when it comes time to the on-site assembling of the house of God. And that's where they drew their line. And they passed the first test. They did it. They passed the test and they drew the line and they stood up for the issues at this time. They did not compromise. You look, though, brethren and sisters, in the Bible at some of the people who did compromise and what it cost them in ecclesial life. You look at Lot and the story of Lot, a righteous man who cared about following God. Yahweh was his God, and yet he moves down to Sodom. He gets involved politically and judging at the gates, it seems, from Genesis chapter 19. He sat in the gate at Sodom, and he made some political compromises at that time. And in the end, look what it cost Lot and his family. When he comes out of Sodom, hardly anybody's with him anymore. He's just got a few. And even those, you wonder like to what extent they were really part of the community at that time. You look at the incident with Judah, where Joseph is down in Egypt serving God in a foreign land, sticking to his Bible principles. Judah's back there in the land doing all kinds of business and economic adventures, involved in compromising alliances with people of this world. Compromising his principles. Having a friend who says, oh, that's no problem if you have an adulterous relationship or you've got a woman on the side. No problem, we'll get it. Well, I'll take that gift up there for you. And you know, this is the kind of friendships that he had. The people that were not encouraging him in any kind of Bible principles at all. You look at a good man like Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, a king who was so given to unity and trying to unite the northern and southern kingdoms because of what it had cost his dad. This man was committed from the beginning all the way through. He was going to try and bring unity and never let what happened with his father occur in his lifetime. He tries a marriage alliance. He tries all kinds of alliances. He has economic alliances. This man had political alliances. Jehoshaphat was constantly trying to unite the community in the northern and southern kingdom. But look at what it cost the community. It was not the right time. The angels didn't want that at this time, and Jehoshaphat was actually moving against what God was after, and he constantly had to keep being reminded of, wait a minute, and so God would wreck the ships that they had made together, or God would do something where he comes up to have the military alliance with Ahab, and he almost lost his life, and he cries out to Yahweh, and God saves him at that time, and Ahab's killed. But look at what that marriage alliance cost the community. You go through this period of years where once that they had married off, when he had married off his son to Jezebel's, well, at least it appears as though that's Jezebel's daughter, Athaliah. Athaliah comes right into the community and brings in all of her wicked things. And then Israel goes through a period, that Judah does at least in the south, where you start wondering, like, is there anybody left? Because, here Athaliah takes over the kingdom, kills off most of the royal seed. And people were starting to wonder, like, wow, was this alliance really worth it? Look at what this has done. So there are some times, brethren and sisters, where we have to make some tough decisions in family life and ecclesial life about drawing lines for our young people and for our ecclesia because we care about the long-term implications of those decisions that we make. And we have to prayerfully, with discussions with one another at meeting and in family life, moms and dads get together and we discuss those issues and we try to make good decisions according to the principles of God, praying for God's help that he will bless our efforts and counting on him to make up for any of the mistakes that we make along the way. You look at some of the people in Bible times that made tough decisions in the short run for the long-term benefits that it was going to bring their families. You look at Noah when he built the ark and followed God's directions. And he built the ark and he suffered all the abuse of people that were laughing at him and jeering at him, and his children had to grow up watching all this, and they're building this ark because he believed God and he trusted him that this was the only way to save his family and rebuild a community by wiping out the rest of the world because things had gotten that bad. And if they hadn't done this, God's warning to him was like, I can't even save your family if we don't do something. We've got to do something major. You look at Abraham and what Abraham was willing to do over time and willing to offer up Isaac, willing to let Lot, go ahead, Lot, you pick the land. You pick which area you want first. He's willing to make these decisions in the short run because of the long-term benefits. Abraham staying away from some Sodom and Gomorrah. Or his willingness to offer up his son Isaac, knowing that it was a tough short-term decision, but he knew that he trusted his God and that God had good long-term benefits that were going to come from this, even if it meant resurrecting his son from the dead. He totally believed that that was what God would end up doing. You look at Moses and the decisions that he made with Pharaoh, of demanding that Pharaoh let the Jews go, following God's decisions, even though it cost them. These Jews, will take away all their, they go gather their own straw to make these bricks. And it seemed like every time Moses made a good short-term decision, things got tougher and things got tougher. It's like Joseph's life. He makes a good call and it's like the angels brought more trouble into his life and more trouble and things got harder. Testing us, finding out what we're made of. Are we willing to believe that God knows what he's doing? You look at the story of Rahab the harlot. And how easy it would have been for Rahab to just, when those people came knocking on the door and believed that God was going to somehow save her and just say, well, those spies, they're up there on the roof, or, turn them in. She risked her life for those spies, believing that her God would somehow save her from this short-term decision because of the long-term benefits, because she cared about her family. She wanted all of her family saved. That was the deal that she made. She cared about her family, and she was willing to make some tough, short-term decisions that risk her life. She puts her life on the line because she cares about her family and what's coming. Well, they survived the first test, brethren and sisters, and it's nice to see that when that test came along, that they had learned from the past. They had learned from the archives of what their aunts and uncles and moms and dads and grandpas and grandmas had gone through, and they drew that line so that they would not have to repeat it. But then, the second test, you see. The second test that comes along in ecclesial life and in family life is, well, we made that good decision and we passed that test, but now, are we willing to live with those consequences that may cost us some sort of long-term endurance? Are we going to endure over the long run? Are we going to patiently trust day after day and year after year that God really does know what he's doing and we got to keep going in the work? And that's where a lot of us have trouble. It's one thing to make a short-term decision today and just say, well, yeah, I'll stand up today for what the right thing is. But then over time, when you start having to deal with that decision and all the things that come from that, and we get worn out. And year after year, we have to deal with those decisions. And people keep coming after us. So here's the test now from the outside, you see. Look at what these Samaritans do. Verse 4. Actually, it's also interesting to note, just so you can see in terms of strategies, back in verse 3, when they gave the answer, when they gave their answer to the adversaries as to why they were not going to allow them to build, they didn't really tell them exactly the truth. Did you notice that? Because really, their real reason was they had a moral line that they drew and these people were not going to work with us. That's the decision that the elders and Joshua and Zerubbabel at the ABs, they would have had. We cannot do this because morally this is wrong. This is what caused our captivity in the first place. But when it came time to tell the adversaries, do you see what they did? They jumped on the fact and they said, well, look, you can't help us build because we alone will build as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. There's the authority issue. And so they went back to the decree of Cyrus and they said, you know what Cyrus said? When he made his decree, he said, all of us who are up here in Babylon, he said, you are free to go back and you can build that house. He didn't say anything about any of you in the land helping out. And it's an interesting concept when you look at strategies for trying to build answers and develop answers in ecclesial life and family life. Now, for moms and dads here that are like trying to work with our children and we're trying to like always trying to work things out with our children, sometimes it's not exactly good to be upfront and tell outsiders all the time exactly why we can't do things and participate with them. And so we may give them another reason. But what we tell our children, we make it very clear. Our children understand what that real reason is. And you can see that in this case, they did a little of that here in Ezra chapter 4. So now what happens is, well, now you have to live with the consequences. You won't let us build? Well, we're going to make things tough on you. We'll see whether or not you would have wished you had changed your mind. So in verse 4, the people of the land, here's these adversaries. These are these people who came and said, oh, yeah, we really want to help you build. We really want to help you build. Sure they did. The people of the land, when they couldn't build, they didn't really care about Yahweh's house. They didn't care about these people having their building built so they could worship their God. What they really wanted to do was just be a part of their life and have them join their life and join in with them like that on their level. And so now what they do is they try to discourage the people of Judah. And they troubled them in the building. And in verse 5, they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Through that whole span right there, they were working against them. And now the trouble begins. Here's the second test. You can see back in Israel's archives where they had had times where they momentarily would come to life and a king would arise like a Hezekiah and he would get the people together and he'd get the sacrifices going. He'd rebuild the community. He'd get the temple worship going again and people would experience these momentary revivals. But then over time, you'd find, wow, it all dropped back off again, and then everything would come back down. And then a Josiah would come along, and he'd get everybody pumped up, and he'd try to destroy all those idols again and try to get the people going. But it was becoming much more difficult as time went on. And the real test, brethren and sisters, for ourselves is, can we endure to the end? Are we willing to suffer all those things through an entire life of whatever God gives us in our lifespan, where he's allowing us to learn, to spiritually learn lessons all those periods of our lives? Can we stick with it and patiently endure and trust all those things that the angels bring into our life that our God really does know what he's doing? All those troubles, the children that we might have and the struggles that we go through with our children, or the people that God brings into our ecclesia, our ecclesial members, and he brings in people and other people leave. Are we willing to trust that our God knows what he's doing? That's a major endurance test that each one of us has to pass and really believe in full confidence that those angels know what they're doing because they have our eternal life, they have our best interests in mind. And they know what we need. They know what the rough edges of all our stones and what they have to knock off of us so that in the end they can just slide us right into that spiritual house and we will fit in as a member of the family of God. They know what they're doing. We just have to believe. And in this case, here's the test. Are they going to be able to withstand the persecution and the endurances? And you can imagine what happened. They hired people against them. They were bringing folks in them that caused them all kinds of trouble. They probably brought in people that were coming at them and attacking them. They were probably stealing their supplies. They were probably raiding things that were coming into the community. And they were taking them away. And they were doing everything they could. They might have been going after their farms. They might have been setting fire to the food that they were. We don't know, but they were definitely working against the project in every way they possibly could. Then they frustrated them all these days. And that's where it becomes very tough for us, brothers and sisters, to find out, are we going to endure to the end? How far are we willing to go? Well, when you look at what happened in this period, I want to just take a second and see if we can catch on to who these kings are. I spent a lot of time in my life trying to figure out who these were. And I'll have to tell you up front that you won't find agreement in the Christadelphian community as to who these four kings are. You see in verse 5 that they hired counselors against them all the days of Cyrus. Well, everybody agrees who Cyrus was. That's Cyrus who made the original decree. So all those days of Cyrus now, right on through his last 8 or 9 years while he's still reigning as king, they frustrate him those days. Until the reign of Darius. And we're all pretty well agreed on who Darius is. Or Darius there, he's the king of Persia. He's the fellow who's called Darius Hystaspes. So there's no debate at all when you look at your little timeline. Everybody agrees that Cyrus is this man right here who is a Persian king, and Darius is this Darius Hystaspes right here who reigned for 36 years. So where you'll see differences in our community, and it tends to be differences in our community, at least in our writers, between Australia and England, is that our English brethren tend to take that the reign of Ahasuerus and the reign of Artaxerxes, they think that what these fellows were are the ones who came afterwards. So you're going to, if you ever read like any of Brother Michael Ashton's things or some of the other books that are out there, Fred Pierce, you'll see that what they did is take Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes to be this fellow here who's Xerxes. They think he's Ahasuerus. And then the Artaxerxes right here, they take to be Artaxerxes Longimanus. So they push this period way beyond the building of the temple. However, if you read things from Australia, you'll notice that a lot of our Australian writers, as well as you'll see these differences amongst the outside writers of reference books as well, they take it to be a different period. And here is what they'll do. They'll say that what this is, and to me this makes a little more sense, is that this Ahasuerus and this Artaxerxes are actually occurring in between Cyrus and Darius. That what verse 5 is, verse 5 gives us an overview that they hired and they frustrated from the days of Cyrus all the way until the temple was built. There's Darius when it finally gets finished. And here's what they did back in this fellow's reign in between. And here's what they did back in this fellow's reign in between. And I think if you look through this, you'll see that it pretty well fits the context of this chapter because it's all about the building of the temple. It's not about way beyond down in here at all. It's all about, we know the temple was finished in the 6th year of Darius right in here. So it's all about this period right in here that these adversaries frustrated them during this time. So I think what you'll see is the fellow that we generally call in history, we call Cambyses right here, who is Cyrus's son. He is probably this fellow right here who's called Ahasuerus in verse 6 of this chapter. And in the days of Artaxerxes right here, is probably this fellow right here who's called Gomedes by some and Pseudo-Smertus. As you'll see when we look at it in a little transparency, you can see why he's called that it's actually referring to those kings. And if you look back in the history of the Persian kings, here is what the angels did at this time. It's just really sort of fascinating to watch how they were out there orchestrating the political events just like they are today. There's no difference. They were as involved in politics back then and setting up these kingdoms as they certainly are in these last days. So Cyrus came along. He's a Persian king along one family line, and he's the one who issued the decree. His son, Cambyses, took over after Cyrus died, and he reigned for about another 8 years. But then after Cambyses, what happened is Cambyses was killed. And he was killed, and somebody took over who they think claimed to be his brother. This fellow here who's called Bardia right there, History knows him under different names. He's sometimes called Gomedes. Some people call him Pseudo-Smerdis because this other fellow here, this Bardia, was also known as Smerdis. And they call him a Pseudo-Smerdis because he was a fake. He was an imposter. That what he did is he had Cambyses killed, and then when Cambyses was out on campaign and he was dead, while Cambyses was out there on the campaign and gone, he stood up in the Persian capital and he said, well, I'm his brother. I should now take over as the king. And for 7 months, this fella here, this Gomedes, took over, claiming to extend this family line. And when people got back, when the army came back, and they all realized what had gone on, they killed Gomedes, they overthrew him, and they sort of like got together, the Magi at that time, as the story goes, they like flipped a coin, and they picked up Darius at this point, and he comes in as king. It's under a different family line. So Darius now takes over, who's now Darius Hystaspes, and this is the fellow when the temple's finally finished in his sixth year. And then after him comes the Xerxes and the Artaxerxes that are on your little handout right there. So it's a fascinating political situation, and you can see how the angels would have been controlling the events at this time to bring this all about. So I think what you'll see when you look through the rest of this chapter, that the reason that we know that this is really this King Artaxerxes, the key is, who is this fellow right here? Because what these adversaries do in Ezra chapter 4 is they write their letter and they say, look, we've got to stop this. We've got to stop this building. These people, they're building the walls. They're building this rebellious city. And they make up all these lies. Lies in this chapter. And when you look through the letter that they write in Ezra chapter 4, they're telling, because they're claiming they're building the walls of the city. They claim they're building up the city and it's going to rebel against you. And you can see that what was happening is that when they did this, when they claimed all these lies, who did the angels have in power at this time? But what they had done is they had orchestrated the events to have this fake king in charge for these period of a few months, so that when the letter comes to this man and he reads this letter and he says, oh, these people are going to rebel. They're building this rebellious city. They're going to rebel against my kingdom. And he's all worried because he's a fake king anyways. He sends out a letter and says, stop the work. And that's it. And they had to quit. And you can imagine how all of this was brought about so that all these things would happen at the right time, at the right place. The angels bring him in for only 7 months to test the community. Now you get exactly what you wanted. You didn't want to work on this temple. You wanted to build your own houses. You wanted to do your own things. You wanted to allow those discouragements to depress you and get out of ecclesial work and not work anymore. So the angel said, well, you can have exactly what you wanted. Stop. And they put a halt to the work. And the work on the temple stopped when this man came along right here. And it only stopped, though, for 2 years. You know, sometimes we get the feeling that the work stopped for this long period of time. 2 years is all it stopped. And God sent them Zechariah and Haggai that we'll look at tomorrow to get the community going again, to build up the spirits of Jeshua and Zerubbabel and get everybody going again. And by the end of this chapter, by the end of the chapter that we're in right now, I think you can see that somewhere on your little handout right there, I gave you these kings, gave you a little bit about who their names are in Ezra 4, what their actual names are in the historical record. So you can keep track of who they are. I found that to be a nice, useful chart for this chapter. But the reason that we know that this Artaxerxes right here is not the Artaxerxes way down the line is because this Artaxerxes is the one who responded to this letter. And you can see that by the end of this chapter, at the end of Ezra chapter 4, this is not way beyond the work on this temple. Thus, in verse 24, it says that the work on the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, it ceased. And it ceased as a result of the letter that Artaxerxes wrote down and in the letter that they had written to him. So this Artaxerxes must be this Gomedes, his Pseudo-Smerdis. And in the end, the work on the house of God ceased because this fellow was scared stiff that rebellions were going to occur in his kingdom. And brethren and sisters, you know, it's so true that we watch these angels working in our lives. We see how they can so easily orchestrate these events in the last days, and they're doing it right now. And if we think we're discouraged and depressed in ecclesial life or family life, think about the angels for a moment and how excited they are that all these things that they've been working towards, the establishment of God's kingdom in the end, they can't wait to see it accomplished. And they're working today in the political events to try and bring it about. And let's catch a little bit of that enthusiasm and the spirit that they have, because we know that, as Paul said, that if we are working in the Lord, we have to remember to be steadfast and immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, because we know that our labor is not in vain in the Lord.